This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies,
but we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights
and get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that is full of stars. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
Hi, this is Kent, and hold on, my computer's doing something. Oh, it says there's a problem with the Gunna Geek 3.5 podcast unit, and we'll go fully... malfunction within 2 hours, and I should do an EVA. Should I do an EVA outside the house, or do you think that's safe?
And this is Chris, and you're going to find this podcast rather difficult to understand without your space helmet.
And this movie, we're discussing 2001, A Space Odyssey, starring Keir Duella, Roger Lockwood, William Sylvester, Daniel Richter, Douglas Rain, and directed by Stanley Kubrick. Gentlemen, we are coming to what is considered to be the most important science fiction film of all time. Are you ready to tackle the biggest and the baddest of the genre?
Wait, it's the big, it's the most important of all time?
Yes, this
Wait,
is, the one, this is the one that practically is said to be the most important science fiction film ever made. This has been noted by noted film critics such as Roger Ebert, as well as filmmakers such as George Lucas, Robert Wise, who directed the Star Trek movie. In fact, if you don't remember, when we talked about Star Trek, the motion picture, he was more interested in doing 2001 than Star Wars. And of course, there's a little filmmaker named Christopher Nolan, who also deems this to be one of the most important films ever made. So, are we ready to tackle this bad boy?
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we're going to do it anyway, so get over it.
Well, probably the best way is dive right in and tear into it, because I know some people on this have their own opinions.
All right. But I guess the first question that I should ask is, when were you first made aware of this movie? When did you see it first? And I can't, why don't we start with you?
I believe I have been aware of this movie since my birth. It has ingrained itself in me. Well, actually, I think this movie, knowledge of this movie actually does predate a lot of my earliest memories. Because I remember my older brother having a model of the, Pan Am flight shuttle and me playing with it when I'm like 3 or 4 or 5, and him of course getting pissed because, oh my god, the little kid is playing with my model. So I have an association going with it. I just don't remember when I actually first saw the film, because maybe I just saw clips for a while before I saw it. So, but as far as I'm concerned, it's always been there.
I see. What about you, Chris?
I think I saw it for the first time like 10 years ago. And it was like, it's one of the first movies I got when I first got Netflix, like the actual DVD thing from Netflix or whatever.
Nice.
And I mean, I guess I always knew about it before then. It was just, it took me that long to get around to it. So,
well, since you weren't here for our Full Metal Jacket episode, what is your association with Stanley Kubrick as a filmmaker? What was your first Kubrick experience? How long has this gone back with you?
Oh man, I got to pull up his stuff here, because like I've seen a lot of his stuff and I kind of like him and hate him at the same time.
So what about Kubrick's work do you like and what do you hate, out of curiosity?
Like with 2001, like it's visually just incredible, but like at the same time, it's it's like his pretentiousness comes through in the movie. So like it also like pisses me off at the same time.
Now, I'm going to go ahead and reiterate something that I mentioned when we talked about Full Metal Jacket, which is that in my opinion, when it comes to Stanley Kubrick, he makes visually alarming films. They're the kinds of movies that you take frames and you could put them up on a wall. And that is something, especially when we talk about this movie, there are going to be several scenes that I will be mentioning specifically that has that particular aspect. But I guess, Kent, I mean, just to kind of reiterate, what is your impression of Kubrick? Or has that changed since Full Metal Jacket?
He has his own unique style. We'll just say that.
Well, that is true. Now, keep in mind that we'll probably be asking this question again once we get to Clockwork Orange and The Shining at some point. Not this year, mind you.
And Dr. Strangelove, in case, you know, the world ends at some point.
And Paths of Glory.
That's an art house. Yeah. Art house legend guarantee. If it looks like there's a nuclear war, we're doing Dr. Strangelove. Just because, you know.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't know if anyone will be around to listen to that, or maybe it'll be like in the wasteland, like Fallout.
this movie does lack humor. Like Dr. Strangelove had dark humor comments in it. Clockwork Orange has some weird stuff. Full Metal Jacket has. Oh, really? You're making jokes like this? Well, yeah. Of course, that's the time to make a joke. Nobody really makes any kind of comment. I mean, you have two astronauts on a mission, and you figure there'd be inside jokes between them or something, but that never even comes up.
We'll be talking about that. Let's go ahead and let's move in.
There's a lack of humor. That's what I'm saying.
That is true, but we will be. But let's go ahead and let's. Because this is a pretty big damn movie. In fact, I could almost say we could easily do 3 to 4 hours talking about this movie, to be quite honest. And just to make it clear, you know, me and my good friend Caesar, who's been on the show, we've had 6-hour arguments over this particular movie. And I do want to reiterate, multiple arguments that have lasted up to 6 hours over this particular movie. So there is a lot here to discuss and a lot here to break down. We're not going to get that deep into it, I don't think. Let's just go ahead and let's get into this. Now, the film is highly controversial at the time. Now, bear in mind that when it came out, the critics were divided on this movie. Yeah. Half the critics, and especially the biggest. Film critics of the time, the New York Times when it came out was highly critical of this film. New film critics were coming in and they were defending Stanley Kubrick from the more established. This was a change in kind of the changing of a guard in regards to film criticism at this particular point. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that Kubrick's film lacked conventional storytelling techniques. Things that had been pretty much established as being the norm for telling stories up to this particular point. Now, we're talking about 1968 here. This is, at this particular point, the 60s were kind of a change in filmmaking altogether. We were seeing independent films coming out through this particular point. We're seeing kind of a changeover from the usual Hollywood fare of the 40s and 50s into something that's a little bit more robust, a little bit more challenging for audiences.
'60s is also a shift in science fiction too. So this is the time of between Star Trek, Twilight Zone, all that happening on TV.
Well, if I'm not correct, Twilight Zone came out in '58. If I'm not correct,
'58, close enough to the '60s.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying that it isn't. I'm just saying though that.
So, okay, so Doctor Who's but, yeah, science fiction too. Yeah.
So, but again, let's talk about science fiction up to this particular point, because it was also a change in the style. And Kit, out of curiosity, you're pretty familiar with that transition, not just in science fiction films, but in science fiction novels and pulp, right?
Not for that. For that era, a little bit later, but the era is kind of the fiction between the books and movies mirrored each other close enough. This was kind of radical that it didn't have like bug-eyed aliens everywhere.
There's a reason for that, and that becomes the space race. When John F. Kennedy had basically challenged us to go to the moon, our focus on science kind of expanded. And so the possibilities, especially after the human being was capable of leaving the Earth's atmosphere with both the Russian cosmonauts and the Mercury missions. And at some point, I have a feeling we will be talking about the right stuff probably in a couple of years or so when we get close to the anniversary for that film. But science fiction, the thing is that no longer was the possibility of leaving the Earth's atmosphere outside the realms of it being imaginary. We could do it. And especially when it comes to science fiction writers who have a science background, as we would see with the likes of Isaac Asimov and it's considered what, the Silver Age of science fiction, if I'm not correct.
I don't know if this is still, they count him as golden.
Yeah, but
it depends on who you talk to and who's like, oh, well, this is the best stuff ever. It's like, really? But
and then, of course, it brings us to basically the person who really started 2001 off, which is Arthur C. Clarke. Now, out of curiosity, have either of you read any Arthur C. Clarke, and specifically 2001 or The Sentinel, which was what this movie was based off of?
I've read 2001, 2010 and seen the movie, and 2061. And I think I started 3001 and couldn't get into it.
I only got two chapters in and I couldn't move any further.
Yeah.
But what about you, Chris? Are you familiar with Arthur C. Clarke as a writer?
I'm not, no.
I will say, though, that I'm not big on the 2001 series from Clarke, but one that's been teased to be made into a movie by none other than David Fincher and Morgan Freeman, which is the Rama series, which I still think would make a great movie at some point. But
I've heard nothing but good things about that. So.
Yeah. So Rendezvous with Rama and the Rama series, in my opinion, is definitely one that I'm very eager to see come to fruition. But the thing is that Arthur C. Clarke is a science-heavy science fiction writer. He bases a lot of his stuff on current understandings of science, and he doesn't like just adding elements into science fiction that aren't things that can't be based on real science. Now, it's not to say that it's all completely science-driven, but a majority of it is. He wants to make sure to have as much of it in there as possible. And in fact, a lot of the next generation of science fiction writers going into the 70s and 80s came from Arthur C. Clarke. One that comes to mind specifically for me is Ken Stanley Robinson with his Mars series, which I don't know. Have you read that?
Red Mars, Blue Mars, Green Mars.
Yeah, I don't know if it's in that order. I think it's Red Mars. Is it Red Mars? I thought it was Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, but I could be wrong.
Okay. I've heard of them. I haven't read them.
It's pretty intense. Arthur C. Clarke was highly influential. And you have to understand, this is the same period of Isaac Asimov with him and his damn robots. But... And yes, and whenever I talk about Isaac Asimov, there's two things: his damn robots and the greatest science fiction saga of all time, which is Foundation. The idea of them doing either a movie or TV series both kind of invigorates me, but terrifies me, because I don't know how on earth you're going to be able to do that without basically Game of Thrones money. But
yeah,
or Game of Thrones, HBO's backing or something like that. It's pretty hardcore. Well, but all right, so let's go ahead and let's get into the movie itself, because while Arthur C. Clarke was the guy who initially envisioned the concept of what would become 2001: A Space Odyssey, we also have to talk about Stanley Kubrick as a filmmaker up to this particular point, because through the 60s he had made both Spartacus as well as Doctor Strangelove, and so up to this particular point he had gotten a lot of renown for doing films that were both conventional but at the same time also a bit subversive in regards to Spartacus and Dr. Strangelove specifically. And 2001 is a bold departure in both the style and the tone of the earlier films that he had done. I mean, also adding in Paths of Glory and The Killing and Lolita as well. And so, this is, I guess the question that I'd bring up in regards to Stanley Kubrick here is that, considering the other work that he's done before, could you imagine what it'd be like to step into 2001, not exactly sure what you're catching, and coming out of that? Could you kind of see where critics and audiences kind of didn't know what to make of this?
Especially if, like I said before, though, no subversive humor slamming on something like Dr. Strangelove did. And then at the same time, it's like, well, there's a lot of this movie that doesn't, the movie doesn't move as fast as Spartacus does, and that says something.
Well, Spartacus is 3 hours long.
I know, and Spartacus doesn't even move that fast. So I could see I could see the initial audiences going, huh? What did I see? But there's a part in one of the documentaries about the making of the movie where it says in the first 30 days they were going to pull the movie because it really wasn't doing that great. And I'm sitting there going, 30 days in the modern era, if it's not good, if it's bombing like that after a weekend, it's gone.
Well, you also have to understand the way that films were released in 1968 and the way that movies are released now, there isn't that immediate reaction. There's no way of gauging that. And on top of that, this is a pretty big movie from MGM. There's a lot of money that was put into this movie.
But after 30 days, it apparently found its audience.
Well,
it makes me wonder if the audience was, I know acid isn't big for another year, but what's...
I'm actually going to put it out there. I think that three letters actually did, in fact, help this movie out, and that is LSD. Because...
Not H-A-L.
I'm sorry, but this is...
it's a trip.
The drug culture of the 1960s definitely played an impact on how this film... in fact, I want to say that even after they noticed that the counterculture had really taken to this film, they tried to advertise it to the counterculture. They expected people to drop acid or to partake in illicit substances going into this movie. They didn't outright say, go in high, but they also kind of made sure that the advertising was targeted towards that particular demographic. And they came out. And especially when you get to that last 15 minutes, you can understand why probably illicit substances definitely helped, especially at that particular time. Huh? But what do you think, Chris? Do you think that particular advertising kind of helped it, or do you think that there was something else?
Oh, it totally helped us. Because, like, I mean, that's the only reason it was successful in theaters,
right?
That's
how you watch this movie?
I think I would have liked it more if I was on theater. Oh. But you had to, like, I couldn't imagine, like, seeing the beginning of the movie and being like, okay, I'm on LSD. And then, like, it's after 2 hours and you get to the fucking ending.
It's washed out of your system by the first. Yeah. I don't know how long it takes, but yeah.
You'd have to wait for like the exact moment.
You'd have to take a second hit halfway through. Just the,
there's like an art to match it, too.
That's like, what intermission is for.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's why it's a 2.5-hour movie. I mean, there's no movie that's 2.5 hours that requires an intermission. Especially where the intermission is placed, that is not a very...
It's a weird spot.
Yeah. That was... You could tell that that was definitely put there specifically to allow people to go into the bathroom and drop something before... Yeah. We're not talking about a number two either. There's definitely the reason why they put that intermission there. But still, though, I mean... That is, yeah, that's a, oh boy, yeah, I can definitely understand why MGM had decided to put, to kind of target this specifically to the counterculture. And I think that in a way, this also kind of soured the relationship between Arthur C. Clarke in Hollywood, because I think in a way he was kind of intending this to be a love letter to science, right? I mean, and I'm going to give this to Ken specifically because you said that you've read the books. Do you kind of get that with Arthur C. Clarke and his work with 2001?
I would say so, but it's also in some of the later ones, it's a marriage of science and how it affects society and the after effects and how
mm-hmm.
things work from there. Because like all I remember from 2061 was it's mostly in, it's a lot less to do with the monolith and more to do with culture going, hey, there's spoiler for 2010. Mm-hmm. There's two suns in the sky. How did that happen? How does that affect things? And why are some governments total dicks to everybody about it? So,
well, that's true.
And the South Africans are the bad guys. So,
well, you know, free South Africa, you son of a bitch. Oh, I'm sorry, wrong movie.
Well, all right. Well, it's partially because when something happens to Jupiter,
mm-hmm.
there's like now almost moon-sized diamonds running around the solar system.
Nice.
And they're like, and it's like, oh, wait a minute, we're just figuring this out. We could actually grab those, mine them, and do stuff. Oh, no, that would destroy the planetary economy. Like, no, it wouldn't. It would destroy your economy if you're mm-hmm. all you do is diamonds, but hey.
Hey. All right, so let's get back to 2001 specifically.
Yeah.
Now, the film is broken up into three chapters. Now, before we do that, let's talk about the opener, because...
Which opener, the 15-minute symphony, or
the title sequence?
Okay,
because we have to talk about "Thus Spoke Zarathustra," right?
Yes.
This is this movie was made by this song, and this song made that, this movie made that song, right? It's a pretty, how do I put it? I'm surprised that this song is as short as it is. I honestly thought that it was longer. Then
it's the opening. The whole thing is very long, but this is just the opening movement to it. And then it's like, okay, we stop, we turn the page, we have the next movement.
Mm.
It's a multi-part thing, and this is part one of it.
Oh, I see.
And it's actually technically called Sunrise, the segment.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense, especially with the visual we get right off.
Well, yeah. I mean, in a way, yeah. I want to say that this is the first time that cinema has tried to recreate realistically what space looks like from the vision of the moon, in a way, right?
And it turns out they got it slightly wrong. But
well, you know, it's...
That's the funny part. It's like, Earth's actually... better looking than that. Wow. So it was kind of cool, but yeah.
But on top of that, though, especially considering that, that it's kind of setting up the relation to this film in space, the relation to this film in Earth, and especially with this particular music, which I don't know why I keep thinking that this song is German. It just, it feels German, doesn't it?
I thought it was. Well, maybe it's because of the name, but...
Well, Zarathustra, if I'm not correct, is Greek, isn't it?
Zarathustra is actually, because he's one of the founders of Zoroastrianism. Mm-hmm. So it's actually farther back than the Greeks, but so,
yeah, but
I forget the composer, who the composer is.
Yeah, is it Wagner? Because if that's the case, then that makes sense.
I think it is, but
yeah. Well, yeah, it definitely feels like Wagner, and anyone who's a classical music nut can feel free
jump
to
jump on us and tell us where we're wrong, because yeah.
But it definitely has that grandiosity, that kind of magnificence, that glory, yeah, that you know, just power, and that's a great way to open a film. We'll talk about if the film deserves such a great opening. We'll get into that, but it definitely is. It definitely opens the eye, right? It's or not even just the eye; it's the ears specifically. You know, it sets us up for an odyssey. I mean, it, you know, going back to the title itself. I mean, when you use the word odyssey, especially when you bring this back to Homer specifically, you're expecting this to be pretty epic. You know, that's kind of how you're supposed to see it, right? I mean, is that what the image that you're getting when you see the word a space odyssey?
Odyssey, yeah. You, of course, who's nobody in a space odyssey? No, not to get too Greek, but mm-hmm. You do expect to go epic journey kind of thing. Yep. And we start pretty epically at the dawn of civilization after we've... looked up at Earth from the moon and gone, hey. Mm-hmm.
What about you, Chris? Are you getting that Odyssey feeling coming into the opening scene?
Yeah, but I mean that usually comes with, like, whenever a movie like sets itself to like classical music, especially when it's like grandiose and that kind of setting, you know, it's just, I always get that epic kind of feeling. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but yeah. So yes, mm-hmm. Long answer. Too long. Don't read answers. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely get what you're saying. So yeah, let's go ahead and let's get into chapter one, which is the dawn of man is what it's called. I'll be honest here, especially after Thus Spoke Zarathustra, to be watching a bunch of monkeys. Not exactly what I was thinking. You know, when you're coming off of that song, right, off of that piece of music, you know, especially when they're just basically hanging around, and especially long after the first time I've seen it, I can't help but watch that and think about a certain music video by Bruno Mars. I think you know exactly which one I'm talking about. Which is not, again, not a good thing that you want me to be thinking about watching the opening of your epic Odyssey movie.
Well, to be fair, this is before Bruno Mars.
That is true. But let's be
unless
honest here.
You subscribe to... Yeah.
When you have something, yeah, some epic music, the first thing you're seeing is just a bunch of monkeys hanging around, just like doing nothing.
Yeah.
It, in a way, I almost want to laugh at it. Just a little bit. Now, thankfully, it does have... Now, if it was just a flash cut from the music to the monkeys, then I would have laughed. But they do use the fade in and fade out. So with the Dawn of Man, so it does give you a chance to kind of prepare yourself. You know, it's in a way, it's almost kind of biblical. I don't know. Maybe I'm giving a little bit too much credit here, but you know, that kind of fade in, that gradual fade in, that gradual, you know, kind of also kind of time to the sunrise in a way. You know, kind of tying it back to the sun a little bit. But are y'all getting that as well? Or what are y'all thinking about the opening of Dawn of Man?
Well, with the name of that movement being Sunrise, and this is the Dawn of Man, then yeah, it's a perfect fit. It's like, mm-hmm. It's almost like he was flipping through a catalog of music and went, Yes. It's the dawn of man, and this is it's the dawn of well, what will become humanity as soon as they start beating the crap out of each other with weapons.
We'll be getting into that in just a second.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that the first of many caveats that this film is going to be demanding of its audience, and maybe it's more of a modern thing, but those monkey suits look horrendous. Can we agree that those monkey suits are really, really, really bad?
I didn't think they were that bad.
I had heard that the reason they didn't get a nomination for any costuming for that scene was they thought they were using real monkeys. Somebody thought they were using real monkeys and put it out there.
Then
for 68, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, it's not Planet of the Apes level. Well,
no.
Although
the thing is that I thought so the first time that I saw this film, which was, I want to say, 2000 actually, just before 2001, was the first time I saw this film. And even then, the monkey suits that were used just kind of turned me off. It didn't feel realistic at all. But I'm surprised that other people, especially you two, it seems like y'all pretty much bought these particular monkeys. So maybe it's just me.
Listeners, comment and agree with me. So, yeah. I mean, or whoever you feel like agreeing with.
All right. So did y'all find yourselves kind of wondering, like, so this is 2001, A Space Odyssey, and we're starting with Dawn of Man with monkeys. Did y'all, especially considering that this is a pretty lengthy sequence, did y'all find yourselves kind of wondering, where is this going?
Yeah, it's at the entire movie.
Well, once the monolith shows up, it's like, okay, what was that? And it's like, okay, this is something happening.
Okay. Now, I will say, though, that one thing that I'm going to give Stanley Kubrick about this movie is the fact that he does kind of set up the structure of the environment. So when we have the sequence of the monkeys at first kind of just digging around and, you know, not really kind of communicating with one another with the exception of grunts and stuff, it does set up the self-consistency. So it's not like it's going to have them, you know, giving us, you know, little, like, you know, either them talking in English or kind of subtitles or something like that. We kind of have to figure out what it is that's going on so that when the monolith does come around, we are constantly asking ourselves, what is this information that we're being provided and how is this impacting the scene as we're watching? And that's something I will give Kubrick here, because others would probably want to immediately just kind of hitch over the head with what this scene is trying to go for. And so we are constantly asking ourselves, what does this mean? What is the point of this? Right. Is that what y'all getting from this, or are y'all finding this just really frustrating?
I've seen a couple different interpretations of this.
Okay, but not going into interpretations that you've seen other people talk about just yet. I have a feeling we have to talk about your impression of it overall.
Right.
Because this is a movie, unlike other movies, there are so – I want to go back to Donnie Darko when we were talking about Donnie Darko in the sense that there are a billion interpretations.
Right.
Of this particular film. So you can go through a billion of them. In fact, I went onto YouTube and I found nearly like 30 of them within just like 10 minutes of one another that were all trying to explain how they understand 2001.
Yeah.
And, well, I'll just be honest here. They didn't – when I had actually posted comments trying to get them to explain how it is that they came to the conclusions – and almost all of them ignored it. Well, of course, maybe it's just because it's been too long. Or I've actually had some tell me that you just don't get it, and that's not a defense. You know, you can't use, well, you just don't get it. the film has to be able to interpret. You have to be able to understand what the film is trying to tell you.
If there's a core problem with all the interpretations and such, it's that some of in the film overall, and I'm getting way ahead of myself, mm-hmm. but some of it overall is in the novel and it didn't get transcribed into the movie.
Now, are we talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey book or The Sentinel? Because bear in mind that 2001, A Space Odyssey, the book came out after the movie. The Sentinel was the source material.
Well, they were kind of, if I understand right, they were written in parallel because 2001, the novel.
But you also have to understand
the monoliths on Saturn. It's not an orbit around Jupiter. It's Saturn. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole extra thing where, like, we go to Jupiter, we actually do science, and then they go to Saturn.
Yeah, but the thing is that Kubrick doesn't ever feel compelled to follow the source material. Is anyone who's read either Red Alert, which became Dr. Strangelove, or The Shining, or Full Metal Jacket for that matter, will tell you. He does not obey the source material. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing is that he's going to make the movie he wants to make, whether you like it or not. Yeah.
So it depends on what the Kubrickian interpretation of what he wanted to get across, as opposed to the Clark and what Clark wanted to get across.
Yeah. But at the same time, though, Kubrick, okay, if it's anything like what Stephen King said that his experience with Stanley Kubrick was, I wouldn't be surprised if Stanley Kubrick constantly called up Arthur C. Clarke every 5 minutes with a different question that had absolutely had nothing to do with the movie itself. You know, I love how King put it one time. You know, King got a call like at 2 a.m. from Stanley, basically wanting to ask if he believed in God. And, you know, and for some reason, this was an important question in regards to the movie. I don't know. We'll get into Kubrick in just a little bit as a filmmaker. But this particular scene, though, in this particular sequence, it takes a while for it to build up, but we do kind of, we have to establish how the society works, because once the monolith occurs or it comes to be, things change. And so we have to establish the before we get the after, right?
Yeah.
And this is important. Oh God. It's like, all right, I'll just go out and I'll start tipping my hand a little bit here. What is important for this chapter may or may not be important for the rest of the film. And that's one of the arguments that I have with anyone who defends 2001 A Space Odyssey. Because people will say, oh, this is important because we have to see the evolution of man. We see man before the monolith. The monolith occurs, they use tools. Then, of course, we have the tossing of the bone up in the air, and then it becomes a spaceship. Which is supposed to show the transition of time between man's beginning to man's middle, which technically speaking was man's future, into 1968. So,
well, and right there, there's a couple caveats going on, because you say tool use, but is it tool use or weapons use?
Tool. Because remember, the first time they use the bone isn't to hurt someone; it's used to use for a task. It's only after they're attacked that it's used as a weapon.
Is the task he's using breaking up that skeleton a test run where he's realizing?
No. You get this.
What he could do later.
For me, at least, I get the sense that this was meant to be used as a tool for breaking things. For, I guess part of me is also thinking about the creation of dynamite.
Because
TNT was not designed for war. It was meant to break up tree trunks or tree stumps and for farming. It was only when someone had the brilliant idea of using it to blow up.
Take out a fortification. Yeah.
You know, and that's also how we get the Nobel Peace Prize, by the way, is because of this.
It was great for farming. I mean, that did help.
Well, he
picking out tree stumps did help. But when the bone gets thrown into space and becomes a object in orbit, that's not according to other sources, like I said, not translated in right. That's supposed to be a weapons platform.
No, it's not. It's a air shuttle because we see what's inside there.
You see the shuttle a few moments later. Those are different ships. The shuttle passes by it.
Oh, you're right.
It's two different things.
It doesn't establish that it's a weapon. You come at
not
that
in the not in the movie. Not in the movie.
I understand that, but we have to go with what the movie says. We can't use other sources because we don't know if that was the intention of Kubrick or not. You know,
that's frustrating.
Well, it is frustrating. I'm not gonna lie to you. There's a lot about this movie that's frustrating, especially in the context of science fiction. But the thing is, though, is that we don't ever see other weapons. We don't see guns. We don't see explosives. Everything that we see after the use of the bone to hurt is ultimately a tool. In fact, I will say that this movie is as focused on tools as it is about the nature of man, which is pretty heavy in this film. I think we can go ahead and say that this is a movie that's existential in nature. Can we have that agreement between the three of us that this is an existential movie?
I never thought of it in those terms.
I mean, do you really believe that the ending of this film is signifying something that is realistically going to happen or something that is plausible? Because we had this argument before.
We'll get to the ending at the ending and figure out what it means.
Okay, we've had this argument before when it comes to becomes existential to realistic. So we need to establish, is this existential or is this a realistic depiction? What about you, Chris?
I think it's fairly realistic until the giant baby comes into the picture.
It's before the giant baby, before we get there, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, I mean, now bear in mind that there are other movies that will definitely be playing on the line between realistic and existential, and especially with certain filmmakers that I just mentioned before that were trying to do their own Stanley Kubrick things in their own way. But Ken, I do just want to kind of give you a chance to reiterate. Do you believe that this is more existential or more realistic?
I'm tempted to say, why can't you have both? But
right, well, okay, well let's go off of this argument. Let's go ahead and let's move forward with this because I will say one thing. The first scene that I absolutely kind of admire as a scene is the docking sequence, especially with the use of the Blue Danube. That is beautiful. Come on, you have to, even if you don't like the movie, that is a beautiful shot. Beautiful scene. You gotta give it that.
The whole, that is, well, even before that, just being asleep on a space airplane, very restful.
Pan Am, by the way. By the way, I think Pan Am had gone broke before 2001.
Yes, they were, but they were big at the time, and they were expected to keep going, and you know that's what you do. I mean, we've been like this with Atari and Blade Runner. Come on, it's the same thing, same kind of thing. So yeah, I mean, it's a nice thing, and the science kind of works that she's props to the actress here. She's pretending that she's trying not to float when she's obviously in gravity. But she's pretending that, I'm having trouble walking. And she's wearing basically socks that are a future Velcro is what's going on.
That's what it is.
And I like that.
What I think it is the way that the ship is rotating. Because you have to understand that it's rotating on a Y-axis. So, well,
the shuttle isn't. The shuttle doesn't rotate until they get to the station. And that's just so they can dock. So they can match the station. Because the station has the artificial gravity.
Well, I thought that she was walking when it was starting the docking sequence. It wasn't until...
She probably was checking the passengers.
Because if she's rotating with the y-axis, then that could artificially generate gravity. In that sense, I'm perfectly okay accepting that.
Yeah.
But come on, Chris, you got to give this scene. You got to give it the scene. Please, you know, if you do.
Of course. Yeah.
This whole thing is beautiful.
Of course. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I love the whole... The visuals of the movie aren't really... Mm-hmm. I mean, if you dislike the movie, I think you're going to say...
That perhaps Stanley Kubrick is the first music video director of all time?
Oh, yeah. Originally, at the beginning, I was going to be a VJ from an alternate reality talking about how Stanley Kubrick's new music video for also sparked some for us. 2.5 hours. VJ have fun, guys. Which, you know, parts of this are a great music video.
That's the thing. It's like... It's scenes. I mean, there are three major scenes that are just absolutely gorgeous out of context.
Oh, yeah.
Out of context. These scenes are amazing. But I have to admit, but after that shot is done and the music video stops, and then we have who will become like Roy Scheider in the second movie. But I forgot the guy's name.
It is the same character.
It's the same character.
Except they had to recast because, you know, too many years had gone by.
But the guy wasn't a major actor. He was just basically a stand-in. They needed a heavier guy. Is that Floyd? Yeah, it's Floyd. Haywood Floyd. That entire sequence, I'll be honest here, I get the sense that it's trying to set up the next part, you know, the next chapter. But quite honestly, considering everything else and considering that we really don't truly understand what the hell is going on anyway, what is this scene actually signifying? Is it trying to establish the world that we're in, kind of what has happened between 68 and 2001? Because even though it doesn't outright say it, we're assuming that this is 2001, right?
By the next scene, this is 2000. Because Discovery launches...
When
we get to Discovery, it's 18 months after this. So if this is January of 2000, we're in mid-2001 by... the time we get to Jupiter.
Okay.
Which is actually pretty fast, actually. But so this also could be 1999, but it's close to that.
Yeah. So Discovery 1 is the events in 2001, right?
Yes.
Okay. But the point of this scene, is it really kind of signifying the universe? Because we don't really get a whole lot of exposition, with the exception of, you know, of seeing kind of a video call from home, and it's basically just it's personal stuff. You know, it's Floyd's daughter's birthday, and you know, he's just talking about it, but we don't really talk about what's happening between America and the Russians, or the Soviets, because you know, this was still back in the heart of the Cold War. We'll get that in 2010, mind you, but we don't really get that in this one. But at the same time, though, there is a lot of secrecy about what they found on the moon, but they don't really say exactly why it is that they're being secretive about what they found on the moon, right?
It's like a weird slice of life going on. We're just going to lock onto this guy and follow him, and so hey, he does normal stuff. He does small talk. And wait, what's the small talk again?
Well, it was...
It's what? There's a ban on part of the moon? What? Oh, you're going there? Well, it must be a plague. Oh, well.
No. It goes there for a reason. I mean, he's a government man. There's a reason for him to be there. But they don't really kind of give him any information other than to come up here and see what we found. But, you know, he does have a couple of conversations, basically like, oh, how's your golf swing? Stuff like that, you know, kind of, you know, usual businessman type stuff. And then we get, you know, and then we take the trip out to the monolith, which, of course, they said that they found something, but they don't unearth it until he gets there, because the whole point is that the monolith doesn't hum until it hits
until
sunlight.
Oh, I thought it was until it was touched.
I thought it was when the sun touches it, or that it hits the sun, and then it then that's when it starts buzzing, right?
Ah, that's a good point that I don't remember which one okay. it is. So.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing with the monolith in the Dawn of Man sequence, is that when the sun hits it, then it reverberates, and that's when we get the bone. And I guess we should go ahead and talk about the monolith for a little bit here, because this is really the connection between the three chapters, right? Is this monolith or these monoliths? I have a lot of questions about the monolith. Number one, the first time when we see the monolith, it's just placed there, right? It's just like it was there. It wasn't there one moment, and now it's there. And then, you know, if there's a bit of like looking at it, oh, what's this? And then sun hits it, it makes this high-pitched squeal. And then all of a sudden, they're using tools. So I guess the two major questions I have when it comes to the original monolith, and we'll talk about this in regards to the monolith they found in the moon. What about this monolith would give this inspiration? And two, why is it that this monolith isn't still there? Do the so-called intelligent life, because there's a whole bunch of, there's this thing about aliens are the ones that brought it, right? It's aliens monitoring us. So what, they bring it, it does a buzzing, and then they take it away?
I always thought the one on Earth was the one on the moon. It got moved after it did its inspirational thing, and then they moved it to the moon.
Well, no, because the reason why it doesn't is because whenever they talk about the one that's on the moon, it sends out a signal out to Jupiter, which means that the monolith's was still there.
There's another one at Jupiter.
Yeah. So it was contacting another monolith. It was directing them to Jupiter. And they don't say that it disappeared. That one disappeared.
The moon one is still there.
Yeah.
It doesn't go anywhere, but I'm pretty sure the moon one is supposed to be the one that was on Earth.
But then, why doesn't the film make that clear though? Because the thing is that we don't actually see the monolith move. Well, the monolith is there, it buzzes, then they use the tools, and then we don't see it again. But we don't.
They throw
ever
the
see
bone, and we're in Act Two.
Technically speaking, the Blue Interview is part of Chapter One. Chapter Two doesn't happen until after the second monolith. Reverberates, because then that's when we go to Chapter Two, what they call 18 months later, you know, Discovery One. Okay. 18 months later, that's Chapter Two.
I'm fairly certain those are the same monolith, but I'm not sure where I get that from. If that comes from other source or it's.
And now we're going to get into the part of this 2001 thing that I really wanted to kind of bring up, which is when it comes to people's interpretations of this film. It's a lot of it is what people bring to this film. This is kind of like the Dagobah cave of film.
Yeah. That is really good.
Seriously. I mean, literally every time I talk to someone about 2001, people bring up what they think is happening, but that the film never supports. It's like, so they bring their baggage, they bring their interpretation, but whenever I ask them to kind of justify it, they can't, because it's not in the film.
It's one long Rorschach test. What did you see?
Maybe. Actually, that is it.
Yeah. To bring it into more scientific, even though it's exactly what you just said. But
then the argument will then be, does that equate good art? I mean, when it comes to a Rorschach test, and does this film match it, considering that science fiction is pretty is a genre that kind of requires that you be able to follow along with what's going on,
right?
And I do want to kind of bring this up in comparison to another film that came out relatively recently, but we'll get into that in just a little bit. But what about you, Chris? Well, what are you getting from the monoliths? Do you have any kind of interpretation about what the monoliths signify in regards to the film and in these two particular chapters or these two particular scenes in the same chapter?
I mean, for some reason, I always thought they were all the same one. I didn't ever think there were multiple ones. But as for what it is, I have no fucking clue.
Yeah.
So basically, this is the whole point of the monolith is to inspire, but we don't know exactly how it inspires. It just inspires monkeys to use tools. Yet at the same time, though, that when it comes to the second monolith doesn't actually inspire anybody, but it just points them in the direction of Jupiter.
Well, that makes me think it's the same monolith going, it inspires at the beginning and then goes, bye guys, I'll see you when your tool making lets you get to the moon.
So you're saying that the monolith is sentient?
Semi-sentient. Not exactly. I mean, it's on a level a little bit, it's maybe like an animal intelligence, like a dumbed down HAL that's like, won't speak to you, but will show you what to do. And was given instructions by its creator.
Hmm.
And is very patient because it sat on the moon for God knows how long.
Not good.
But that's, again, bringing an interpretation. That's probably a brand new interpretation that I'm bringing to it. But
I don't know. The thing is that if the monolith is a dumbed down version of HAL, then that means that humanity has outpaced the alien intelligence.
Well,
which, especially when you get into chapter 3, that's not really the case.
Well, you can make a dumbed down version of anything and say there might be a better version of it out there somewhere. It's like, we left this dumbed down version because all it has to do is inspire you and then point you in the right direction. That's it.
But if that's the case, then what's the point of the monolith? I mean, the whole idea is that the monolith has to kind of not just inspire, but to, if it's the same monolith, if it's the same one, then what is the point? It's like, okay, I'm going to give you the inspiration to build tools, and then I'm going to wait for you to have the tool, to develop to the point where you can make it to the moon. And then I'm going to wait for you there. And then I'm going to point you to Jupiter. And because you already know how to get to Mars, then you're definitely going to make it to Jupiter in 18 months, mind you.
Well,
18 months.
That's a thing. It's a lot easier, quote unquote, to get a manned mission to the moon than it is to get a manned mission to Jupiter.
Well, I'm just saying, though.
It could be a lot harder. And we also don't know if the manned mission to Jupiter was already planned. It may have already been,
but we're building
the ship, and then, whoops, let's do a change of plans, which they do mention later on. There was a change, but...
But that's the problem here, is that the contrast between Monolith 1, or the first sign of the monolith, there's millions of years? I don't want to say millions, but definitely hundreds of thousands of years... from the time that the first monolith is seen to the second, and then from the second one to the third one is only 18 months.
They may have thought it might have taken longer, but hey, humanity is good like that. We're awesome.
I don't know. Oh. It seems like, it's just like the first step is to, the first step is to run a million miles, and then second one is to, all right, just go over there, over in that corner right there. I don't know. The whole point of if you're trying to elevate humanity to a higher state of consciousness, you would want to gradually be there to mold it into kind of point in the right direction, but to constantly make it bigger, make it more advanced. That's the thing. It's
these aliens are weird, though. They're kind of.
But we never see the aliens. Oh, bear in mind.
We never do see them.
I mean, again, we are assuming that the intelligent here, because for all we know, it could be that the monoliths are sentient. We don't know. But it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense if it does, because if that's the case, then why not be there the entire time? Why not watch over and make sure if it's a sentient thing? I mean, I don't know. That's the confusing and frustrating thing about this movie. But I don't. So let's go ahead and let's move into the second chapter, because this is where I'll be honest here. If they would have made the movie just this section, I probably would be liking it a lot more than I'm feeling at this particular point with each time I've seen this movie. I have to admit, I really love the introduction of the characters in this particular chapter. I love how it sets up, especially our two main astronauts and our artificial intelligence, Hal, right? Because we have Dave and we have
some other guy.
Well,
we have Dave and Frank.
And
I love how it establishes the scene, because we have I think Frank is the one that's basically suntanning in space, and then we have Dave, who in my second favorite, or actually my favorite scene, but it's the second one in the film, of him running up the walls of the spaceship. I'll tell you right now, whenever I think about 2001 A Space Odyssey, I don't think of Hal, I don't think of the monoliths, I think about this guy running in circles in space and the way that it was shot. I love this. Shot. It's beautiful. It sets up the scene. It sets up the character. It's a very unique visual. You know,
you get to see backgrounds and go, what's that station for? What's that station for? Holy shit, are those coffins?
It also kind of sets up a realistic looking spaceship. The one that doesn't that doesn't apply in just, up and down, left and right, I don't want to go all Ender Wiggin here, but, you have to think in three dimensions, not just two. Right.
Right.
But
yeah, part of the ship spinning gives you the gravity, and he works out in it, and it was a healthy thing that they were discussing astronauts needed to do back then, which is still doing today on the International Space Station, except they don't have gravity up there, but they work out.
Mm-hmm. This ship is spinning,
part of the inside is, from the blueprints, part of the inside is spinning up in the thing.
Well, I think that's maybe that's kind of a retcon in regards to the movie.
Right, because it's a very small area.
But at the same time, though, I also love the fact that we have a clip of a radio or of a TV interview that the astronauts have done. Which also sets up what's happening here. It sets up kind of what the mission is, although we don't know exactly why they're going out there. It also sets up Hal, which of course is possibly the most famous character in this movie, right? I guess let's go ahead and let's start off with Hal. What is your initial impressions about Hal? What makes this character unique, other than the fact that it is an artificial intelligence that we only see basically a blinking red eye? Or not even blinking, it's just a static red eye, right?
He has been always there, so I mean he's been in every. It's kind of hard to say first impressions about Hal when he was in pop culture when I was a child, and he was. You kind of knew Hal before you knew this movie even existed, because he's been in joke. Hal Simulcrum jokes have been everywhere. Even to the point where you don't expect something to go, what are you doing, Dave? Which is something I have said to people named Dave before.
I mean, if you know a Dave, and especially if they're a science fiction fan, I feel like you're obligated to do the Hal voice. But let's talk about the Hal voice, because I have to admit, the one thing that I absolutely love about this character, before I do though, Chris, what about you? What are your impressions of Hal?
When I was watching the special features, I found it interesting that they pointed out that the astronauts are actually more robotic than Hal is over the course of the film. And Hal's the one that's more human. And like,
well, he talks about his feelings, which is something we don't ever see the astronauts do.
Yeah, and I mean, he's obviously my favorite character. So, like, you know,
because he kills
for a lot of people. So, yeah,
kill, obviously.
Yeah. kill. Well, he doesn't show emotion when he's doing it.
Well, I will disagree with that. I'll disagree with that a lot. But the thing I will talk about when it comes to Hal is his voice. Because he doesn't sound menacing. He doesn't sound robotic. He sounds pleasant. He sounds nice. He sounds emotional. He you know, whenever he's talking, he's sounding like a friend, right? He never comes off as cold or heartless, you know. And that especially comes through, especially when we get to later on in his scenes. Right, because when they're talking to him, he's talking friendly with them. He gives his analysis, but he kind of peppers it with the kind of niceties that we would hope with a friend, right? To make that it's programmed. It's programmed to be this way in order to make him make the astronauts more comfortable to talk with him, right? And I guess it's the one thing that I don't know if it was intended to be asked at the time, but definitely moving forward in a technology heavy society is that connection with technology that we would hope for. And I guess in a way, what Kubrick is trying to go with in this is our relationship to technology. Right, our relationship to the tools that we use, our relationship. I guess for 1968, let's talk about the car, the plane, transportation specifically, right? And how we'll give our car a name. We will, ships. I mean, even to the point, if we go back like 200 years, we gave ships names, right?
Even longer than that. I mean, for what's interesting though is, okay, the ship is Discovery. Hal is its own thing. You don't call. I mean, Hal runs the ship, and he's built into the ship.
Hal is the ship.
But they did. Wait. So why don't you call the Hal Discovery? Because he's a separate individual.
Well, because you would have to call the ship Hal, which I think.
Or you call the computer Discovery. Hey, Discovery, how are you today? I'm doing fine. Thank you for asking.
But Hal does have a lot of control over the ship and is given a lot of leeway, as we'll definitely see later on. But I find it very interesting the way that Hal talks to the astronauts, especially considering the miscommunication. We'll call it a miscommunication for now, but in regards to the failing part.
Yeah.
Right? Because when Hal mentions that there's a failing part and we're told that that's not really the case, that leaves us with two options, right? Either Hal is wrong or Hal is lying.
Right.
And so what do we feel about that? And I'm not talking about just in the tone of the film, but just if we had a computer that we knew either was lying to us or was providing inaccurate information, would that change your relationship with that technology?
Well, it's interesting. They never checked to see, okay, how do you know it's failing? Oh, because of these diagnostics. Are these diagnostics flawed? Maybe it's not you. Maybe it's not the part. Maybe it's something in between. And Hal goes, oh, it must be you guys.
Well, no, that's what he says. Is that it's human error.
Right, which is pretty damn arrogant of him to say that. It's like, oh, come on. It can't be us. It's got to be, could you not have a bug? But I'm a Hal 9000. I never make mistakes.
Yeah, that is
it's almost like, it's like they've been sold. The salesperson was very good at telling everybody, yes, Hal's never screw up, ever.
Well, that's like, what you get from a laboratory from Evanston, Illinois. Let's just put it that way.
Hey, no, it's not slam. I mean, Evanston is actually a very big, I want to say that's University of Illinois' graduate department. for computer sciences. So that's not, I know somebody who got their PhD from there, so that's not a insignificant thing. But at the same time, there's been people pointing out how, let's see, if you transcribe the letters one direction, suddenly you're an IBM 9000, and we know those things mess up all the time.
So. Well, I also find it interesting that IBM also used a HAL commercial, I believe in 2001. Promote their latest line of technology. So there is that too. But what about you, Chris? How would you know in regards to your relationship with technology? Would that be changed if technology was knowingly being inaccurate with you?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. But I have to admit, though, you do bring up a really good point when it comes to why didn't they ask? Why didn't they look at the diagnostics? Why didn't they check the background?
Double check. Because they trust it so much. At the same time, they kind of do the right thing and think about, okay, we could keep them around. Mm-hmm. He can still run these systems. We might have to disconnect them from these other systems just to be safe. Yeah. But...
So in a way, we are at this point, we are stepping into the existential, right? Because at this point,
right.
Especially as we see with astronauts of that time and later on, they don't allow their systems to be completely automated. They require a backup that they can use to bypass. And in a way, they do, because they do have the ability to... to
the emergency entrance works without HAL being able to even touch it.
Well, yeah, there's the emergency entrance, but they also have the way of turning off HAL.
Right.
But at the same time, not without killing most of the crew.
HAL does that before they.
Yeah, but why would they allow HAL the ability to turn off the
life support?
Life support.
He just runs life support. He could alter it in case something. If he got an odd reading from something, he could try and fix it.
But to turn it off, you don't allow that kind of control.
That's a programming oversight, because you would never get into your mind that HAL would try and kill them. So therefore, you don't put in the instruction "thou shalt not kill" because you know, HAL would never do that.
I'm pretty sure that Clark had talked to Isaac Asimov at this particular point.
Right, yeah.
Which, of course, I'm pretty sure Clark did, but I don't think Kubrick did. Just saying. No. Or if he did, he probably just ignored him and go, humans would.
It is good drama to see the computer decide, kill all the humans.
All right, so let's talk about HAL killing the humans. Why? What is your interpretation? Why did HAL decide to that he had to murder everybody?
This is one of the things that is set up that we do get to see, but you really have to draw it out in your head. You really have to think about everything that's happened before up to the point where you see the explanation. And then in 2010, of course, they just spell it out for you.
Well, tell me, what is your interpretation?
Well, he said every time you talk to HAL, he's like, I would never lie to you. I always tell the truth. I do this. I do that. I'm very truthful. And I'm here to give you all the information you want. What's the last thing we see as we're killing HAL is that recording of, oh, by the way, guys, here's the real reason you're going to Jupiter. We told HAL. HAL wasn't allowed to tell you.
But why? That's the thing that.
So he went.
Go ahead.
If you can't perform almost an existential thing of what's the one thing you have to do? Tell the truth. Here's something you're not allowed to tell anybody about.
But did they ask what the mission was, and did he have to lie, or did he just omit?
Lie of omission, according to HAL, would still be a lie. And if at any point they go, how do you know at some point they're not going to go, okay, HAL, I need something boring to put me to sleep. Read me the whole mission statement of what we're supposed to do.
But if they would have done that and he said, I'm not allowed to, then at that particular point, we could definitely...
He's not allowed to even say, I'm not allowed to. That's part of the point.
But the film doesn't ever test and, that, though. That's the thing. We don't ever have one of the astronauts.
We don't have a test because I think Kubrick's expecting us to just go, oh, he's been told the lie and he's not supposed to lie.
But we don't know that. That's the thing, is that, and this is one of the frustrating things about 2001: A Space Odyssey. Kubrick is either assuming that we're going to understand exactly what he's saying, or he's expecting us to come up with our own interpretations and just leaves this blank, which of course means that whenever we do have these types of discussions, there's no genuine definitive reason, which of course in science fiction is especially concerning.
Is good. Yeah.
The destination that we're going. It's not that the destination isn't very vague. We know the final shot in the film does make it clear what has happened. The problem is, how did we get there? And that's the question that you have to be able to answer. If you set up a destination, we have to know how we got there. If we don't, then that's going to leave a problem hanging over your film. You know, if you want to leave it vague, if you want to leave it to where the audience basically decides where the next step is, you know, if we got everything but the final shot, well, first off, I think a lot of people would have been pissed off because then they would have realized, okay, well, what the fuck did we go through all this for? But at the same time, though, at least there wouldn't be this kind of like, you know, how do we get there? And I think that's what the critics of the time were really frustrated about, is that it didn't explain how we got to the point that we did. Right? And even if you go to like Roger Ebert, when he talks about 2001: A Space Odyssey, he just completely ignores it. He's like, I don't care how we got there. We got there, whatever. And whenever you talk to anyone who defends 2001, they do the same thing. Oh, we just got there. I mean, if you take my interpretation, if you just look at it through my lens, then it makes sense. You know, and whenever you challenge it, then they go, oh, well, you know, it that doesn't matter. So I guess when we get later on into this, we'll get into interpretation. But what about you, Chris?
What about me regarding
regarding Hal and Hal's behavior?
I mean, I always took it as him just trying to get like when he was trying to beat them to the punch, you know, because he reads their lips. He sees that they're going to turn him off. So
do you think this is entirely self-defense?
Self-defense? No, I think it's just kind of, oh, you're going to unplug me. Fuck you guys.
Well, wouldn't that be self-defense? No. I mean, you're going to kill me. Therefore, I'm going to kill you first.
I guess. I mean, I guess I didn't really think of it as self-defense, though. It was just kind of a...
Oh, you think it's just revenge? Like, you know, oh, you're going to kill me, huh? Well, I'll kill you first. But if that's the case, then why did he kill the people in hypersleep? They weren't going to kill him. Especially considering that we get the sense that he's willing to fudge the truth or is programmed to fudge the truth, then he could just basically say, oh, they just went out the airlock and didn't come back. I don't know what happened to him.
He could have done that. Killed the rest of the crew, got to Jupiter, woke them up, and went, malfunction happened. They died. Whatever. Okay, let's finish
now,
the mission.
Now, there is one thing that we didn't kind of bring up just yet, which is the fact that Hal seems determined to finish the mission.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that he is dead set on getting to Jupiter. And one of the reasons why he seemed to be defensive against Frank and Dave is the fact that he was concerned that they were going to turn him off before the mission was completed. So I don't know if that plays any part, because if they're going to complete the mission, then he shouldn't be worried about them turning him off. If that was his only priority, then that doesn't make sense. Now, if it was just basically self-defense, are you going to kill me? Well, I have to defend myself. Okay, well, but at the same time, though, we know that he's capable of fudging the truth. He didn't have to kill the ones that were in the hypersleep. He could make an excuse that would be plausible enough that there aren't going to be too many questions, especially in the depths of space. So why did he kill the ones that were in hypersleep? That's the one. That's the problem that we find ourselves having with Hal's decisions. So at this point, he basically killed them just for a clean, you know, for a clean, you know, to clean, you know, make sure, you know, for something to make it a clean slate kind of thing. But then how is he going to complete the mission considering that he doesn't have any abilities to do anything at Jupiter? He's still at the whims of
He has his full sensor arrays that they were going to use anyway. He can't leave the ship to, like, look at it up close, but he can do scans. He can fly around it. He can send signals into it. He just can't humanly interact with it, but he could do everything else scientifically.
And I don't think he has the ability to transmit the information back on his own. He still requires a human being to do that.
Well, especially after they've pulled the transmitter out of the unit,
so
he can't transmit back.
It's completely defeating the purpose to kill them if the mission means that much. So basically,
well, I think the mission plan was they were going to sit out there, they were going to do the mission, they were going to go into hypersleep, and then Discovery 2 would pick them up.
But we don't ever get that, though. We don't ever talk about Discovery 2 because Discovery 2 is 2010.
Yeah, we do. I think we do discuss Discovery 2 for a throwaway line or something. Because that explains why there's two empty sarcophagus.
Well, that's because Frank and Dave are not sleeping. They're awake.
Two empty ones for them to get into while they wait to be picked up.
But why not just take the ship
back? They're for later, because they don't have fuel. They can't break Jupiter orbit. But Discovery 2 is going to be... Discovery 1 was rushed. Discovery 2 is going to be the one that can do a round trip.
But then
this mission ends in disaster, and they cancel Discovery 2, and then we have 2010.
I'm sorry, but that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. It doesn't. But but it is what it is. So let's go ahead and let's talk about mistrust because everything about the second chapter is ultimately about trust. Dave and Frank do not trust Hal. Hal doesn't trust Dave and Frank and humanity from the looks of it, considering that he basically kills everybody, which, even if it doesn't completely hinder, it cripples the mission significantly. And considering the emphasis that he has on the mission, that seems counterintuitive. But ultimately, though, What do you take of man's trust in his tools? Do you think that in a way that that's kind of an aspect of the conflict between the astronauts and the AI?
Our tools will eventually kill us.
Well, I mean, Cameron made a pretty penny off of that one.
Yeah.
But seriously though, I mean, you know, especially if you compare it to the monkey and the bone, the bone has the ability to kill, but it is still guided by the monkey's hand. Whereas here, the bone doesn't need the monkey to cause harm, right? So the trust in the tool is now, not only the fact that it can kill, but the fact that it can do so without controlling it. Do you think that that's something that's trying to be brought up?
You know, in some ways, I just think it was a bad plot reason to have just one person make it to the end. So,
well, the thing is, I mean, we ultimately have to get there because could you just imagine what would happen if there were all five of the astronauts had been alive when they got to the monolith?
Well, could you imagine waking the three up and them going, oh, by the way, here's the real mission. Why the fuck did nobody tell us?
But we don't even know what the mission is. It fades out.
Right.
All we know is, oh, well, here's the real reason for the mission. And then he just keeps going. So,
well, they say we found this thing on the moon and it sent a signal to Jupiter. So we want to go to Jupiter and see. We think something's there at Jupiter.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's like, well, we kind of figured that part out. It's like we didn't even need to be told that.
The rest of humanity doesn't know it. It's a big secret that they had this. So
damn Russians.
Yeah.
It's like, even 16 years after the time of this movie, we're still having to deal with it. Oh, I'm sorry. wrong thing. All right, never mind. But anyway, I want to talk about the death of Hal right quick, because how do we feel about how Hal is, how Hal fights Dave trying to kill him? The pleading specifically. In fact, didn't he kind of go into the stages of grief in a way? I'm just wondering, because he tries to bargain, he tries to plead, he goes through fear, and ultimately he comes to acceptance as he's being turned off. Now, we can also talk about how technology doesn't act like this when you remove memory.
Yeah, well, we didn't know that at the time. I mean, they make a point. There's one of the documentaries that's done in like 98 or something. They go, we didn't expect that all the memory that Hal contains would be on this disk. And it's like, oh, wow, that's even, we've surpassed that.
The fact that it takes Hal, what, like 5 minutes to die after the memory starts getting pulled?
Well, clearly it was designed by Microsoft and let's do a reboot 20 minutes later.
You sneeze on a Microsoft microchip and it shorts out.
Malfunction. Yeah. It's clearly Hal's logic is all done by USB drives. And as you remove them, that's personality. easy.
Oh, man. But do you feel sad for Hal and that he's basically murdered? I mean, this is murder that happens here, right?
Well, he did just kill four of her people.
Well, that's true. But at the same time, though, it's still murder. I mean, and considering that this is an artificial intelligence, so
Dave's an astronaut, not a computer science technician. He can't fix Hal in the field. He can shut it down and then figure out what to do from there.
But
he can't. He doesn't know how to reprogram Hal.
But
he knows how to.
But here's the question that we have in regards to that, though. Then why didn't just Hal and Dave, or sorry, when did Frank and Dave just go, hey, Hal, we're going to go ahead and just, we're going to shut you down for a little bit. Once we get back, we'll give you a refit and you'll be good as rain. Hal takes this as death, as murder, not as just basically being put to sleep.
Well, Hal, the way it's implied, Hal hasn't been shut down since he was brought online in 1992. Even when he's installed on Discovery.
So the spaceship's 9 years old?
They moved him up and installed him on Discovery while he's still active. Because he says he came online and he's been active since.
But he came online in Evanston, Illinois, so was this...
Right, they moved him to the ship, and still functional, which is bizarre and a big plot hole.
You're telling me they would keep him on during the ship instead of, unplugging him and turning him back on when they get him into the ship, installing him?
Apparently, yes, which is bizarre as hell. But that's how I'm taking his statements to be.
I'm sorry. There is so much about this that just makes sense.
I'll agree it's a plot hole, but it's what seems to be there.
Yeah, you can't. Again, this is very existential. You, at this point, we're out of realism, right? The realism train has left the tracks at this point. The only
other option, and this is interpretation, would be they built the exact same hardware on Discovery, and then they transmitted his program and stored data to that one. So that's where they can say our ground-based Hal is the original that came online.
But
that's the copy.
But basically, though, considering that Hal considers that he has a conscience, that he has a soul, to say, just like with the whole teleporter conundrum, you basically kill the one from Illinois and just copy that to the one that's in the ship.
Right.
So, but Hal would know that. Hal would know that basically he's just a copy of himself from Evanston, Illinois. And if that's the case, then he could also be transmitted back to Illinois. I'm sorry, I don't know. This is just opening a whole new can of worms that I don't think that the filmmakers ever intended, especially Kubrick. And I think that we're at this point fully into the realm of existential. This is no longer realistic, right?
Oh yeah.
All right. So let's go ahead and let's talk about chapter three, or as I call it, the drug fueled phase of the film. I'm sorry, but I this is the reason why people were dropping acid. Oh my goodness. So Dave basically presses on, considering that he doesn't have any backup crew, he doesn't have a computer. He decides that he's just going to go ahead and complete the mission, right? And to get out there without any backup. Why? Did he even at least let Houston know that, you know, that basically everyone is dead?
Were their antennas offline because they already pulled?
Why didn't he plug it back
Frank
in?
Frank was murdered. Frank was on his
Frank had the antenna, didn't he? All right.
Yeah.
So that's true.
Fucking Frank. God damn it.
Well, it was Hal planning the murder perfectly.
Yeah. He thought he had all his bases covered. And for the most part, he almost got away with it. It went for that pesky Dave. It's always damn Dave that always gets in the way. Sorry. Fucking Frank and damn Dave. There we go.
Goddamn Dave. Damn it.
All right. So he decides that he's going to jump into this wormhole. Is this a wormhole? What the hell is this thing? Because I don't think Jupiter is so psychedelic. Or at least that's not the psychedelics that we saw when you know, what is it, Voyager 2? Spun around Jupiter for a bit.
Yeah.
So what the hell is this thing?
I guess I thought it was him making some sort of communication with the monolith. Like that was his journey with that or whatever.
But I mean, if we could communicate with the monolith, why didn't we communicate with it on the moon?
Because you
didn't want to.
It's a different monolith.
Yeah. So like, I wanted to mention Arthur C. Clarke is basically like, if you understand everything about 2001, me and Stanley did not do our jobs correctly.
Yeah.
So they like purposely tried to make this shit confusing and trolled the shit out of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what the fuck? They want you to have all these weird ass interpretations. And is it right? Is it wrong? It's both right and wrong. Fuck you. No.
Oh my god! I will say one thing. When we go into psychedelic land, when he hits that wormhole or whatever the fuck that is, I had a strong Star Trek motion picture vibe hitting me all of a sudden.
Yeah, they mentioned that, and like I couldn't tell if he was in pain during that sequence or like having an orgasm. I didn't know what was going on.
I swore that I was hearing some Jimi Hendrix in the background. Let's just put it that way. Just saying. Maybe even in the God of the Vita, whoever sang that one. But seriously, like, you can watch that with the full end of God of the Vita, with the epic epilogue, you know, the 16-minute one, and you'd probably. Stop around the same point, right? I mean, just saying.
Yeah. You know, not that long ago, but after we had done our podcast on Star Trek the Motion Picture, somebody published a re-edit of Star Trek the Motion Picture that was done to Daft Punk. And nice. I'm wondering if somebody could take 2001 and do a re-edit to 60 psychedelic or Daft Punk
Be
or
great.
Something, and it would make sense.
You know what would be great? If we could actually have it so that they could mix 2001 and Star Trek the Motion Picture and have it so that Dave and Spock like pass each other, just like going in opposite directions.
Oh, yeah, in V-ter, yeah.
Sorry, I was having a Hot Shots Part Two moment, you know, when Charlie Sheen meets up with his dad on the river and they both say, I love you on Wall Street. But
Anyway, sorry. So the monolith itself, you were asking if it was a gate. Well, they actually call it in some of the documentaries a Stargate. Or a wormhole, he's going through a wormhole.
Yeah, I heard the wormhole thing, and but then that's the case, then he's no longer in Jupiter. He's somewhere else.
He's somewhere else.
And
he's in the realm of the aliens, so...
All right, well, if that's the case, then...
Where's that at? Yeah.
Well, you have to understand that from there, he goes back to Earth as a fetus.
Star child.
The other confusing thing is they're saying all that shit in the hotel room is in his head. That's what they said in the special feature.
Yeah,
it's in Dave's head.
How does that manifest him into being a star child? I don't know. That's like
even in the novel, it doesn't make any sense. So
if don't let them get us started with like 2010, where it ultimately comes out to being Jupiter being a star. How does that associate with a star child? Where does the star? I mean, so basically, the star child just shows up, looks around, and goes, "Hey, all right, Earth's cool. I don't have to go. I don't have to be there."
In the novel, he stops a nuclear war because the star child shows up just as the missiles are going off, and he just kind of waves his hand, and all the missiles just disappear as they're being launched. They're like, oops, what the hell?
So basically, X-Men Apocalypse did a better job at stopping nuclear war than Kubrick. Noted.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
It made me think of the ending to Akira, and then like watching this and then Akira back to back, and then my head fucking exploding. So, oh my god.
And then you became a powerful human telepath that way.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
A giant baby.
Giant baby in space. Baby.
Oh god. All right, so yeah, let's talk about this. I don't know if it's a hotel room. I will say though that this is okay. If this is in his head, does that mean that Dave is like royalty or something? Because that's a pretty expensive looking place with a lot of antique furniture. And I don't take Dave as being a artsy type guy, you know, especially considering how Keir Duela is playing this guy, because all of his dialogue is so damn wooden. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if his apartment was basically like Bender's from fucking Futurama.
Yeah. By the way, I have this big closet behind me.
In the special feature, it made it sound like the aliens pulled a certain location out of his head, and that's how they were communicating with him.
But there's no way for us to know if that was pulled from his head or not, because we don't ever see any photos or anything with him signifying that this is a place that he is familiar with. And so in that
there's
case,
no clarification,
Contact does a better job at this than fucking 2001.
Well, they could pull stuff out of his memory and then treat him like a goldfish and give him the best goldfish bowl known to existence, which is, of course, one interpretation. But yeah, he's being put in an environment where he'll be super comfortable. What I want to know is, where is he getting the soup?
That's the thing. It's like,
what kind of soup is it?
Yeah,
seriously. But I mean, okay. So I'll be honest here with the whole hotel sequence. I am completely lost here. I actually went and tried to find something specifically about the hotel sequence, and the best that I have come up with is the fact that this is Kubrick's way of not having to do a montage. Like he wants to show. He wants to show that Dave is aging, or that he is gradually aging, but he doesn't want to show it with him slowly over time aging. He just wants to do it like in five shots. He's just like, okay, let's just do it this way. And it doesn't make sense because one Dave will notice the other Dave, and then that Dave will disappear. But it's like he's both surprised to see him, but he's not surprised to see him. And so
time is meaningless.
Well, that's the thing. It's like
what doesn't help is that they were like, they didn't come up with the ending until they were well into production. So there was no ending when they first started shooting.
Well, I mean,
and they came up with it later on, like way later.
I'm pretty sure that the mushrooms didn't kick in until, you know, about that point. just saying.
Well, there's an old joke that time is how you prevent everything from happening at once. And I think you're in a place where that doesn't apply. Well,
in that case, Interstellar did a better job at doing this movie than 2001. Okay.
Well, that's a later movie, too, where you can go back and study how was this done before. How can we do it better?
There are a billion and one movies that do this better than 2001 A Space Odyssey. That's the point I think I'm getting across with this.
Yeah.
It's like
But did any of them happen before this film?
No. Because no film prior to this has really tried to take space and time as seriously, you know, as this film does. I mean, do we ever have a serious time travel movie that talks about it in an existential level? I mean, not like a Yankee in King Arthur's Court, but kind of take it seriously, you know, to really look at time as part of science. In fact, I think even science fiction novels at this point really haven't taken time seriously. Right. Now this will change, but even by today's standards, most time that we talk about time, we talk about it on an existential level, not on a scientific level. I think maybe four or five movies in the last 50 years have really done that, and that's including Primer, by the way. I mean, if y'all know of any more, please by all means. But at the same time, though, how does this manifestation, this withering of his body, mean that he's transforming into a different being altogether? And if that's the case, then why is it that this Star Child looks oddly human? If this is an alien being, if this is a merging of human and alien consciousness, why doesn't it look more alien?
It's still based on Frank.
Well, Dave.
So it's
Frank's.
Oh, Dave. Frank's dead. Yeah.
Until 3001, and then he comes back.
Right. Then he's back, and he's going, "What the fuck?" Yeah.
Seriously. But all the same, though, I mean. And what exactly is the Star Child supposed to be? I mean, I know that a lot of people have said that this is the next stage in evolution, but evolution doesn't work like that, as any scientist will tell you.
No, I would say it's the alien's representative. Take one of us, toss him back at us, and be something.
But at the same time, is he going to be able to make other Star Child? Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that's exactly what he's there for. That he goes down, he becomes basically a Christ figure, and that he isn't just basically murdered right off the bat because, oh my God, Space Child kind of thing. Kill it before it gets big enough that he could do some damage to us. Because you know how humanity is, even in 2001, especially 2001, as we would come to find out. But still, though, I mean, what the fuck were the aliens thinking? I mean, did they make him, like, impervious? Did he was going to be able to basically command all of humanity? And if that's the case, then that his human side is going to basically take over. And that's even assuming that he has the ability to make other Star Children, right?
That's a big assumption that he can
I know
make
that that's
structure.
The problem though with the whole idea of the Space Child coming back to Earth. Now, if he was going to pull a whole Dr. Manhattan, go, you know what, screw this place, and I'm going to go do my own thing, then that's cool. But if that's the case, then why go to Earth anyway? I mean, that's the problem with this whole damn movie, is that none of it makes fucking sense with one another. It doesn't match. It doesn't work from scene to scene. Like, each scene is pretty cool, but you put it all together and you try to come up with a way for everything to work together. It doesn't work because you could tell that it's been basically put together with scotch tape, spit, and maybe a little bit of Bondo. If anyone thinks differently, please, by all means, tell me how I'm just not seeing it correctly.
It's the open to interpretation ending.
So. But it's not just the ending. It's the rest of the damn movie. Yeah. I mean, the opening of the film, the three chapters really don't match. In style, in consistency, none of it matches because it doesn't flow from one to the other. It's basically three different vignettes for three different movies, and even the science in all three moments don't really match together. There's nothing to tie one into the other other than the monoliths, but the monoliths themselves really don't have any set rules because we don't really see them. They're just there for a second, then they hum, and then they disappear. And we can interpret that hum to be whatever it is because it's not as though the second time that we see it that we get a new inspiration. Basically, it just points us in a direction. You know, we don't have a bone sequence with the second monolith. And I don't know if you could say that the Star Child is really a bone sequence there either. It changes the person physically where it didn't change in the first two times. Right? If I'm wrong, please let me know. The monolith basically does whatever Kubrick wants it to do. It doesn't follow any set rules. We don't understand what is going on. And it,
if you see it as a deus ex, deus ex machina, yes, it is. It is that. It is. I mean, some of this is based on aliens as gods kind of thing, and this is all will of God, so nobody knows what the hell is God's up to.
But that's the thing.
Nobody can figure it out.
But God is an ethereal being, whereas an alien would be of this plane, of this existence.
We don't see the aliens, though. Maybe they are outside this plane.
But they still have contact with this one, because otherwise, how do we get the fucking monoliths?
They can build stuff in this plane or shove it in this plane.
But that still requires them to have contact with this plane. That's the thing.
So?
I mean, and if they can't, then why even bother with us? If they don't have any way of touching our plane, why do they care? Why do they want us to have a Star Child? We don't understand the reason behind it.
I was going to ask, do we have to understand the reason? It's like, of course, they're messing with us, and this is the story, and this is why we have movies. But...
You know, the thing is...
Do we have to have a reason or just enjoy our LSD trips in private?
Okay, a movie either has to ask a question or has to answer a question. Very bare minimum, it has to do one or the other. If it's not answering the question, then what is the question that it's asking? That's my point.
Yeah.
That's the problem with this movie is it doesn't do one or the other. It just throws a whole bunch of shit on the screen and it requires us to kind of make sense of it however we want. At least Donnie Darko, say what you will about how it gets the point across, at least answers the damn question. You know, we don't like the answer, but it at least answers it. This movie don't even do that. And yet, at the same time, this is considered one of the most important films of all time. And I've never found anyone who's been able to answer why. And answer it to fully. I get a sense of, this scene's great. This scene's great. This scene makes me think about things. That's true. The scenes themselves make you think about things. The house sequence makes you think about things. The beautiful shots are amazing. And I will hang them up on a wall. But overall, the whole package from beginning to end is not that great, in my opinion. In fact, I would say it is awful as a whole because it doesn't make fucking sense. This is a great time for anyone to go, no, you're wrong.
Well, the problem is if we jump in and say, no, we're wrong, we know you'll just keep ranting.
I don't disagree.
All right.
This is my point of where I could see it as a great thing. This is the culmination of science fiction on cinema leading to this point. It is prior to this, you have kind of the space bug, rocket ship, UFO thing going on. And here we're out to tell something, a completely different style of story in a completely, not completely different manner, but we're going to we're going to throw all the tropes about going into space and toss them out the window and just do a realistic view of something that happens of weird shit happening. You don't hear a lot of noise in space in this film because that would not happen. You go into a vacuum, you don't hear a psh or anything like that. Like you do, you're trying to do realistically the bizarre,
mm-hmm.
which hadn't been done before either. There's all sorts of factors here that are just coming together to form this, and that's why it makes it a seminal movie of its time. Does it age well? Well, we'll get to that during pass fail. But this does hit a pinnacle of its time and is, I would say, the culmination of science fiction cinema up until this point. And movies afterwards start focusing on society versus science. I would say after this is where you get into society versus science, the tool versus such, because then I can't think of many movies predating this that are science fiction movies that are really character development that don't happen in space. After this,
existential look into mankind and science, why put so much emphasis on realism? I think that's the thing that really bothers me about this film is that
that's Clark. That's Arthur C. Clarke's influence.
Okay, well then there's a major disconnect between the author and the director.
Yes. no debate there. There is some disconnect there. But it could also be Kubrick going, how does this affect what is space like? Him studying, going, what is... Because I don't think you're ever going to see Kubrick doing a space film where you hear laser fire everywhere.
You don't have to have one about laser fire, but...
Right, but I mean, you don't hear sound in a vacuum.
Let me put it this way.
And
I would have been more interested in seeing Kubrick doing, like, Rama. Rama would probably be right up his... alley,
okay,
because
yeah.
quite frankly, that's an exploration story. There isn't action. It's not about that. It's about contemplating man's place in the universe, especially after first contact. And in my opinion, I could see Kubrick doing that in his style, even his psychedelic 70s and 80s style that we will get after 2001 A Space Odyssey. I could see him doing that. 2001, the problem is he's injecting things of his own psychedelic mindset that really doesn't work for the story he's trying to say. That's just kind of where I'm seeing it. If you think I'm wrong, please let me know.
The problem is I don't think there is a right or wrong answer to that.
And I think that's the problem with the movie. You know, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You have to be able to decide, are you going to explore something or are you going to contemplate something? And if you're going to contemplate something, then you have to be able to provide us with some idea of what you're thinking. Coming out of this movie, does anyone know what Kubrick is trying to say about this movie, in this movie? Definitively.
Look what I could do with special effects now.
Well, there is that. I mean, don't get me wrong. The visual effects are pretty astounding for 1968.
Oh, yeah.
It is very impressive. And you know, like I said, George Lucas would say that if there weren't 2001, there wouldn't be Star Wars. And I have to agree with him on that. In visuals specifically. That's true.
Because of all the giant babies in Star Wars, obviously, right?
Yeah.
Also, I don't know if y'all noticed this, or maybe it's just because I'm the uber fan of this series, but if you'll notice that the introduction to Discovery One, the music that was used in that was the same music that was used in Aliens when the Nostromo life pod is found. It's the same music.
Mm.
Bet you didn't notice that, did y'all?
I didn't know.
No, but I don't think I was looking. But yeah.
All right. So, I guess at this point, is there anything else that we want to bring up about the movie? Anything that y'all want to kind of...
I think it's funny that on IMDb, it says that Kubrick cut 19 minutes from the movie after its New York premiere to speed up the pacing.
What was those 19 minutes?
What were they doing in there?
Oh, that'll be in the deleted scenes for the 50th anniversary. You know it.
Oh my god, that's coming up, isn't it?
They shot like 200 times.
That is what I wanted to talk about in regards to Stanley Kubrick, because Kubrick is known for being meticulous about every shot that he makes. You know, he does 100, 200 takes. He's basically worn actors down to nubs after working with them. During Eyes Wide Shut, Sidney Pollack, who's both an actor and a director, mentioned that he thought he was doing like a 2-day shoot with Kubrick and was there for about a month. And if you've seen Eyes Wide Shut and all the scenes that Sidney Pollack was in, it's like, that took a month to do. Okay. So, but the thing is, you know, a lot of people said that this is a mark of an auteur, you know, a guy that's going to constantly, you know, a perfectionist, right? You know, well, we see that again with like the likes of David Fincher and other filmmakers. I don't believe so. But do y'all see this as being perfectionist? What do you take of this behavior?
Asshole behavior. That's what I think. Like, I admire Kubrick's work, like, a lot. I like his stuff, but he sounds like an asshole to work with. Like, I don't see how anybody would have wanted to work with him. Oh, he makes great stuff, but you're practically going to die making something for him. Pass. I think I'll pass.
to bring up Eyes Wide Shut again, a lot of people have said that the reason why Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman, say what you about the closet or stuff like that, but it was said that Eyes Wide Shut was the reason why they got divorced.
Wow.
Well, let's be honest here. That is some pretty damn intense stuff, and that's just in the scenes that we see. And can you imagine having to go through that for basically like 3 or 4 months? That kind of intense, intimacy that was in that particular film. And bear in mind, I actually like Eyes Wide Shut. So that says a lot. But seriously, though, Ken, what do you take of this behavior or of the multi takes that were taken?
I think he was in his right to do multiple takes. Just he's doing a lot of experimental stuff for the first time. He's trying to get it right. And if you're doing stuff nobody's done before, you need to try. You need to keep trying until
200 takes. Okay, now bear in mind. Let me just go ahead and explain what I mean by 200 takes.
Now,
cameras have to be reset up.
Right. But at the same time, doesn't he do that every movie?
Yes. No, but bear in mind, though, that this didn't become a big thing until... Well, Dr. Strangelove did it, but there's a reason for that, and I'll explain that if we ever talk about Dr. Strangelove. But
yeah,
this behavior became... it became a standard by 2001. At 2001, this is when he was notorious for doing this. You know, for 50, 60 takes. Now, when I say that... That's cameras, that's lighting, that's rigging. That takes time to reset. Okay, you have actors who basically are waiting around for this stuff to get reset. You have crew that are constantly having to do the same thing over and over again. The repetition that it requires. We're talking about massive amounts of discipline on everyone's part. And all so that he... can get stuff that he will never see the light of day. Most of the stuff will disappear in the cutting room. Won't be usable. So I don't know. I think Chris is kind of right with the asshole, but I think what it is it's not so much an asshole as much someone who doesn't really know what the fuck he wants.
Ooh. Yeah, an asshole.
Well, no. It's not that he's an asshole. It's just that he wants to have it perfect, but he doesn't know what perfect is. I mean, this is a guy who's done storyboards.
But he knows it when he'll see it, though.
I mean, he does do storyboards.
He knows we've it.
Seen, yeah. You know, I've seen some of the stuff, like when they were talking about AI and his initial plans for AI, and you see some of the storyboards that he did for that. So he knows how to do it, but he just... he just doesn't have confidence in his material. But the thing is that he allows people to kind of say, well, this is just artistic vision. And so that kind of keeps people from basically saying, you know, just calling him out for being an indecisive prick, so to say. So anyway, that's just kind of what I see. All right. So is there anything else we want to bring up? And because we are running kind of late on this.
Yeah. I can't think of much more. So.
All right. Well, then at this point, Kent, do we have anything on the geek sheet?
A lot of the actors for this went on to bit parts and other geeky stuff. Actually, a lot of the actors for this are still alive. Let's see. Here's on The Path currently, which I believe is a Hulu show about a cult or something. Let's see. That's one example. Let me click through here. The voice of Hal has done a lot of documentary overwork, which is kind of funny at the same time.
But he actually did do the 2001 IMDb, if I'm not correct.
Like, he read it off?
Yeah, I think he reprised his role as Hal for the IBM commercials.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. The actor who played Frank has actually done some fan work for Star Trek fan films, which is interesting. But
mm-hmm.
Just interesting because he... Like, wait a minute here. Oh, wait. No wonder he's done that, because he was Gary Mitchell in Where No Man Has Gone Before. Duh.
Yeah, and then Gary Mitchell.
He's Gary Mitchell. Why did? Yeah. Let me go hit my head against the wall. So.
Honestly, I'm having a hard time believing that I know something more about Star Trek than you. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's like, no wonder he was Gary Mitchell in these fan films, because he was Gary Mitchell on screen. I didn't even know he was still alive. That's a crazy thing. So, yeah, it's. A lot of the other bit parts, though, it's like, who is this? Who is it? Oh, most of these people don't even have pictures on IMDb, but...
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, Arthur C. Clarke, you could just go to a bookstore, find his collection.
Rest in peace, Arthur C.
Yeah. And, of course, we eventually will get to almost all things Kubrick at some point.
So, oh, we got Kubrick, we got Tarantino.
Yeah. Oh.
We'll get there.
We'll get to Clockwork Orange and Strange Love.
Yep.
Maybe The Shining first. I don't know.
There's always Halloween. Not this Halloween, mind you, but yeah, others.
Okay, yeah. So, okay. Now for the great debates at the end.
Actually, no, I do want to bring up Keir Dulea, who was Dave.
Yeah. Dave, yeah.
I do want to bring up the fact that he was also in Witchblade as Dr. Emo.
Yeah.
But one thing I really wanted to bring up is that he was in a movie that I mentioned when we talked about High Rise called Space Station 76, which is a pretty interesting movie if you can find it. It's a retro futuristic type movie set in a it's kind of like a, how do I put it? Think of it as a soap opera from the 70s set in a futuristic space station.
That works.
It's pretty interesting. It's not a great movie, but it's definitely one that you can laugh at and have a good time with if you're with friends and booze are involved. But yeah, he was in it, and I have a feeling he was in it specifically because he was in 2001: A Space Odyssey. But But anyway, let's go ahead and call it right quick. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on 2001 A Space Odyssey? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris?
I guess I fall somewhere between maybe and passing, because I feel like the film's major flaw is that its storyline is a fucking incoherent mess. Mm-hmm. But it also, in a way, I feel like that was their last priority when it came to making the film, because they were all about being realistic with like the technology and all that bullshit and being authentic.
If you pass with calling it bullshit, is
yeah,
it's like you failed movies without being so nasty.
Yeah, but I mean, I love the visuals. I love, it's weird how well certain parts of it stand up. Like, I'm starting the movie. My girlfriend had seen it before, but she's watching it and she's like, when did this movie come out? Like, the 80s? And I'm like, no, it's actually 68. And she was all surprised, you know? So, I mean, it's got a weird, authentic vibe to it when you're, I mean, because like of what we talked about, it's like obviously not authentic in other places, but. Anyway, I guess I'll settle on a maybe.
All right, Kent.
So, yeah.
I'm surprised you went maybe. I was expecting a fail.
Was it the bullshit? It was the bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. I want to go a solid maybe, because I respect where it came from to create what it is. I've gone over this before, where it is kind of the pinnacle up to that point. It is definitive science fiction of the time period that exists before Star Wars comes out, and then everything changes because Star Wars. This is it. But it has some serious pacing issues, which a good editor could have helped with at a few points, where just, you know, take a chainsaw to some of these scenes and just, you know, consolidate. And it's not like you don't have stuff from the novel you could have brought in to clarify a few things that maybe you could have kept the length, but put these lines in and made other stuff make more sense. I don't know. But it needed, somebody needed to stand here beside Kubrick and go, you need to do this. Fix this part and we're good.
I would love to see someone and try to do that with Kubrick.
I know. They would have found the body the next day out in the fields. But it's something that, you know, just these minor things that added up that put a tarnish on something that's otherwise fairly amazing, especially for its time and what he had to work with. So it's a solid maybe. Almost want to give it a pass, but just the whole issues with it. It did not age well.
I get you.
And it's not for the modern palette, I would say.
The modern palette?
Yes.
That's putting it one way. Quite honestly, this is one of the seven films that I absolutely hate. I respect it more than I respect the other six that are on that list for the things that it does right. But the problem here is I hear all the time how this is the most important film, important science fiction film ever made. This is a movie that, you know, if you are the only reason why you don't get it is because you're an idiot. Kind of thing. Every time that I see someone try to explain this movie, and whenever I question it, they give me this look like, well, obviously you just don't get it. No, you just can't explain it. And no one can explain it. Kubrick probably couldn't even explain it.
Yeah.
So quite honestly, the fact is I don't expect it to have to answer every question, but I do expect it to be able to have confidence that it knows what it's doing. And this movie doesn't know what it's doing. It doesn't. It's just throwing shit on a wall, and it's just hoping that it sticks. Now, it lasted this test of time, and it'd probably be a test of time. You know, you'll be here for another 50 years, maybe 200 years. But I get the feeling like this is going to be a movie that as it ages out, its impact is going to basically be just its visual, and the inspiration that it does visually. And in that sense, it'll be on par with movies like Sunrise or other silent films that just changed the game just a little bit. And that's pretty much how it's just going to be seen. It's not going to be seen with the same magnificence that it's kind of had for the last 50 years. And it's already starting to diminish. But honestly, I don't get it. And like I said, I'm open. If someone wants to be able to explain it to me in a way that that can answer the questions that I have, where it makes sense, then I'm willing to listen. But so far, all I get is you just don't get it. And you know what? No, I do get it. It sucks. Get over it. But I think it's time that we go ahead and bring this thing back to Earth. Kent, what do we have up next?
Well, according to the little calendar here, we have to go to a police station? What? And bring in some suspects that are very usual?
Well, it sounds like to me like we've got ourselves an Academy Award nominee and winner, if I'm not correct. So we got Bryan Singer, we've got Gabriel Byrne. The only time we'll probably ever talk about Stephen Baldwin in his career. And a little known actor known as Kevin Spacey, if I'm not correct.
Never heard of him.
me neither.
Yeah, so next episode is going to be The Usual Suspects. And we're going to keep this train rolling. Now, just to let you know, we do have our Art House of Horror lineup set up for October. We have a really awesome lineup, and we'll talk about that as we get to the end of August. But please stay tuned for that, because this is going to be a good one. I'm not lying. This is really a strong lineup we got going on here. But gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. Anything you want to bring up right quick?
Art House Legends. It's full of stars.
And if you want to talk about them stars or just tell me how I just don't get it, you can send us an email at arthouselegends@gmail.com. You could also hit us up on our Facebook page as well as Twitter at Art House Legends. And always keep up with our schedule. We will be kind of putting that stuff on the Facebook page probably within the next week. So just keep your eyes open for that. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And this conversation has no purpose. Good night by now.